This is an audio archive edition of WINA's Charlottesville Right Now with Coy Barefoot, made available online by the Charlottesville Podcasting Network, cvillepodcast.com.
Herman Schwartz is a professor of politics at the University of Virginia, the author of three books, the author of more than 800,000 published words. He's taught in Canada and Denmark, and we're honored to have him live in studio to talk about his most recent book, Subprime Nation, American Power, Global Capital, and the Housing Bubble. Herman, thanks for coming in. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Coy.
So let's start real with a quick Herman Schwartz 101. Where are you from and how you got into teaching government and politics and the politics of the economy?
Yeah. So I'm from Philadelphia, but I've lived in Charlottesville for 20 years now, which makes me halfway to being a native.
You're halfway there.
Yeah, halfway there.
So you came in 89. That's
89,
when I got here. Yeah.
Yeah. Long time ago.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. And a very different property market.
Yeah, absolutely.
Than we have today. Yes. In some ways, everything I've done in my career is about property, and about half of it is about property markets. Early work looked at economic development in settler colonies, Australia, Argentina, New Zealand, the southern U.S., Canada. These were all places where land development was the way people made money. And that's the deep, deep connection to this Subprime Nation book. But the more recent connection that got me started on the housing issue was a bunch of conversations that I had in and around Charlottesville and in some other places. And those conversations were the same conversations that people were having at their dinner parties about rising real estate prices. And the conversations that I had in Charlottesville largely revolved around one point, and this is back in 2004, 2005, around one point. And that point was, gee, I make pretty good bucks, but I couldn't afford to buy the houses that are on the market right now. But what does that mean? What does it mean if somebody who's well above the median income can't buy a house in a median-priced house in Charlottesville? So that was one conversation. Another conversation happened in Denmark with a guy that I edited a book with, Len Seabrook. And Len was telling me about being at a bar the night before I arrived to talk with him. And he said, yeah, we were at the bar. It was the old professors on one side. He's about 30, 35. It was the old professors on one side of me. On the other side of me, there were the young graduate students and the new professors. And the old professors were all going, ha, 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 things are great. My house is worth a lot of money. I'm pretty happy. The grad students and the young professors were saying, we're not going to be able to buy a house.
We're screwed.
In this country. Yeah. So same conversation, different place. And then the last conversation was in Amsterdam, another actually very expensive housing market. And that conversation was about jobs. And it was with a Dutch political scientist named Wiemer Salverda. And again, the simple point was housing is really expensive. And people who weren't in the labor market before, and these are mostly women, are coming out into the labor market to supplement the family income so that people can make their nut on their house, make their mortgage payment.
Yeah.
So this was back in well before the bubble was at its peak. And I said, well, this is interesting. I should write something about this.
Herman Schwartz is with us. He's a professor of politics at the University of Virginia. His new book is Subprime Nation, American Power, Global Capital, and the Housing Bubble. So this problem with rising home prices is a global problem, just like gas. It's not just, you know, the folks here in America.
Yeah, it's a global problem, but it's specific to a few countries. It's not all countries. It's not all rich countries. It's the rich countries that have housing markets like the U.S. And by that, I don't mean that prices have risen, but that structural conditions in the housing market make it possible to have very rapid increases in prices. And those structural conditions are that mortgages are securitized. Banks can make loans and then sell them off as bonds.
Creating a secondary housing market. Yeah.
Creating a secondary market for mortgage debt.
Right.
Yeah. That people can extract home equity from their mortgage. And also that a lot of people own houses. And this creates an interesting situation where housing prices can rise really rapidly, powering the economy along, which then validates those rising prices. But at the same time, it means that when things go bad, they go bad really fast also.
Yeah.
And falling housing prices suck demand out of the economy for a variety of reasons. And then people stop buying and the economy tanks, which makes housing prices fall even faster. That's the cycle. That's the part of the cycle we're in now.
Yeah. Now, so, we've been here before, haven't we? As a nation, maybe not this bad, but...
Not to this extent. And the difference here between the boom we've had in the 90s and the 2000s is the degree of securitization. Up until 1980, there was very little securitization of mortgages in the U.S., and securitization started up in the 80s in a big way.
Which means what exactly?
Okay, securitization. You go to the bank, you borrow $100,000 to buy a house. So you owe them $100,000. That's just a promise that you're going to pay a certain amount of interest and principal every month. The bank can take that promise and it can sell it to investors. Now, an investor doesn't want to buy one loan because the risks are really high. Who knows? It might be me. I'm not trustworthy. I'm basically a crook. So banks can't sell a single loan to an investor. Investors are scared of that. But investors are willing to buy 1,000 loans because when you buy 1,000 loans, you average away a lot of the
randomness. Spread the risk around.
Spread the risk around. Just like with polling. If you have 1,000 people respond to a poll, margin of error drops down to about 4%. Same thing with mortgages. If you have 1,000 mortgages, the probability that all of them are going to be crooks is very, very low.
So the banks bundle the mortgages.
So the banks bundle sell the mortgages.
Sell them like they're selling a bond or something.
Exactly. It is a bond.
Yeah.
And so investors will buy those bonds. So that's called securitization because you're creating a security and that a bond is a security. So securitization takes off in the 80s.
Which makes more people vested in the housing market, right?
To an
extent that we haven't been before.
Yes, it means that not only do people have a big stake financially in their own house, but through their pension plans, they have a big stake in the housing market because what the pension plans and the insurance companies are buying are those securitized mortgages.
Yeah. So you own your own mortgage you're making payments on, but through your 401k, you own a whole bunch of bundles of different mortgages.
Yeah. Well, actually, you don't own your own mortgage. You owe on your mortgage.
Right.
So your hope maybe is that it nets out. But yeah, but you have a big stake. Your own house, you buy at a price, that and that mortgage is the price of the house. So you have a stake in the price of the house. But you also might have a stake through your pension in everybody else's house.
So that high level of securitization, when things go bad, it hits us all then.
Yeah, although not immediately. What really has hurt the economy is the fact that housing prices aren't rising. In the 90s and especially in the 2000s, the way things worked was this. Interest rates fell. If you've been here for 20 years, you know this story.
Yeah.
Interest rates fell. People went out and they refinanced their mortgage, which meant they lowered their payment. They had more money to spend. Or they took that same payment and they went out and bought a more expensive house, which put a lot of money into someone else's hands. And by going out and buying the more expensive house, they also caused the nominal value of everyone else's house to rise. So if I buy a house at $100,000 and interest rates fall and I go out and I say for the same payment, I can buy a $200,000 house. What that means is that the neighbor next to me in that new house, their house, which may have only been worth $100,000 the day before, is now worth $200,000. And the bank says to them, if you want to borrow against that new home equity, you can do that. That's the last piece of the American puzzle, is the ability to borrow against home equity.
Yeah.
So people borrow against home equity and they spend that money.
They've treated their homes like a checking account.
They treated their homes like an ATM.
Yeah,
even
yeah.
easier. Push the buttons, the money comes out. And so in the 90s, to a smaller extent than in the O's, but especially in the O's, people cashed out their home equity and they spent that money. And you had a normal kind of demand stimulus operating where people spent more money. It gave other people jobs. Those people spent money. That gave people in the third round a job, made companies invest, and that powered the boom. In the O's, home equity withdrawal accounts for about 0.5% to 1% of GDP growth. In the O's, a home equity withdrawal accounted for about 2% in any given year of GDP growth, 2 percentage points. In other words, if we had 4% GDP growth, home equity withdrawal was accounting for half of that. So people were spending a lot of money that didn't really exist because when they got their hands on that money, the way they got their hands on it is by borrowing. And that's the big debt overhang we have now. So countries that have that kind of American system, they have the same process that we have in the 90s and the O's in terms of growth and then crash.
We're talking with Herman Schwartz of the University of Virginia. His new book is Subprime Nation. So what's the way out?
The way out, Well, I'll tell you.
Help.
If you buy my book, if you buy three copies of my book, you'll have the answer. I don't have a complete answer. I can tell you what people are trying to do, and then I'll give you a little thought about what I think is ultimately the answer.
And when I ask what's the answer, I think there's a personal answer at the personal level, you know, the average Joe in the home. And there's also, of course, going to be a policy answer that governments need to explore.
Right. Okay. Policy answers. The Federal Reserve Bank and the Treasury basically have two pieces in terms of the policy response to the crisis. Piece number one is to make the banks healthy again. The banks are sick because the banks took your money as deposits, either in your checking account or through your money market funds, took that money, and they bought mortgages, these securitized mortgages with that money.
All the bundles of mortgages.
All those bundles of mortgages. And those mortgages are not worth what the piece of paper says they are. People borrowed $600,000 to buy a house in San Diego. That house is probably worth $300,000 now. So the bank faces a huge loss when that happens.
This is all that bad debt that Obama was talking about.
So the bank has a loss on its books, and that loss makes the bank bankrupt if it has enough of them. So part one of the playbook is make the banks healthy again. And the way that works is the Fed has basically said to the banks, we'll give you a free one-way bet. You take depositor money and pay less than 1% on the savings account, or you take people's money market money and pay 1% on that. And you can turn around and you can put that into a treasury bond for 3%. And you'll make money automatically that way. And if you do that long enough, you'll be healthy again. You'll have enough profits to balance the losses that you have on these mortgages. And that's right out of the 1990 playbook that the Fed used to make the S&L crisis go away. So that's playbook number one.
So that does work then?
It works over time.
Yeah.
But it takes time. It took about 3 or 4 years for the S&L crisis to really be resolved through that method. Part number two is a little trickier and very politically contentious. And that is that the Fed, even though its mission is technically to keep unemployment, to keep inflation at a low level, wants to have a little bit of inflation right now. And they want to have a little bit of inflation because mortgages are written in nominal terms. Whether or not there's inflation, if you borrow $100,000, all you have to pay back is $100,000. So if there's a little bit of inflation, say 3, 4, 5%, 6% for 2, 3, 4 years, what that means is that a mortgage that right now somebody only will pay maybe $100,000 mortgage that someone might only pay $75,000 for, it'll be worth $100,000 again in nominal terms, not in real terms, but nominal. And it doesn't matter to the bank that in real terms it's less money, because what gets them out of bankruptcy is that the mortgage for $100,000 can be sold for $100,000.
So you
and
can
don't
use
have to make a loss.
You can use inflation as sort of a fudge factor.
A fudge factor
to push those values up
to make the losses disappear.
Yeah.
So, and that's very politically contentious because inflation, of course, hurts people who are creditors. It hurts the people who have big savings in their pensions. It hurts people who are on fixed income and retired.
Because our dollar is worth less,
And it helps the banks because they're actually net debtors right now, and it helps people who have debts. So there's a fight over there. Ultimately, though, the big problem here, really big problem, is that the distribution of income in America is too skewed up to the top. Too many people at top, too much money goes to people at the top, and not enough money goes to people at the bottom. If you ask why people were borrowing against their houses in the first place, the reason they were borrowing was not just the craziness that said, I need to have the world's biggest garage to put the world's biggest SUV in, and my kitchen has to have stainless steel appliances and granite countertops. The reason that there's so much borrowing against houses is that people wanted to maintain the same standard of living that they had experienced in the early 90s, but their wages weren't rising. In the bottom 80% of the U.S. population, you have very, very small increases in real income in the 1990s. And in the zeros, real income actually goes down for the bottom 80%. So if you're in that bottom 80% and you want to have something approximating a normal, what people consider to be the normal American standard of living, own your own house, two cars, maybe send your kid to college, take a vacation, you're going to have to in the context of stagnant wages, you're going to have to borrow to make that happen.
You got to find money somewhere.
You got to find it somewhere.
And it was in our homes.
Right. And people, that was rational in some sense for these people. People were rational to think that because as long as housing prices kept going up, you could borrow money and it wouldn't matter. You would still have some equity in your house. But if housing prices fall, that's when you get into trouble. So the way to, and here's where the connection is between the banks being sick and the income side. If people don't have enough income, they can't pay back those debts. So right now we have a situation where people have big debts. They don't have necessarily a strong incentive to pay that money back. And because of that, the banks are in trouble. So how do you make that work aside from the two things I talked about with the Fed and the Treasury? And the answer is you have to put money back in at the bottom of the economy somehow. So real income has to rise at the bottom.
So we need more like the Clinton-type tax cuts than the Bush-type tax cuts, which is going to put money into the bottom part of the bottom half of the economy, or that bottom 80%, rather than the Bush method of putting it in the top 0.5%.
Exactly. That's exactly right. Or you have to find some way to take some costs off the people at the bottom, and that's in many ways the intent of the healthcare reform that Obama is proposing.
We are talking with Herman Schwartz of the University of Virginia, professor of politics. His new book is Subprime Nation, American Power, Global Capital, and the Housing Bubble. We're going to take a break here at the bottom of the hour for local news and weather, and we will continue this conversation on the other side. This is Charlottesville right now. Let's rejoin our conversation with Herman Schwartz. He's a professor of politics at the University of Virginia, the author of more than 800,000 published words. He's taught in Canada and Denmark, and his newest book is Subprime Nation, American Power, Global Capital, and the Housing Bubble. We're honored to have him live in studio. And Sarah is waiting patiently on line one. Sarah, you're on with Herman Schwartz. You go right ahead.
Hi, thanks. I guess what concerns me in the discussion is that we're talking about what people want. They want this standard of living that they saw in the 90s, or they want this, or they... And to me, when people are taking out mortgages so frequently, they get advice from a bank, well, you can afford, you can make this payment. And so as opposed to what's the minimum house that I could buy and save more money and have some extra set aside, it's what's the most I can get, how big a house, how grand a house. And so instead of living in a house where children might share a bedroom or scaling down like our parents might have done, it has to be the bigger, the most, of whatever I can afford. And I think constructing our banking system to support this is wrong, and it sets people up to have a problem, whereas they're not making the decisions based on, I guess to me, it's sort of what matters more is that you're being more cautious, you're being more careful, you're living in the small house, you're making do with less.
It's a great question. Herman, can personal sacrifice like that, is that good for the overall economy, or should we be trying to go after the biggest and the best?
Well, three different things. One is it's very difficult to go out and tell people, especially in this country, here's what you must do. And so while I have to say that I'm very sympathetic to what Sarah says basically live the way that she's talking, I don't think that's going to be an easy sell with the rest of the American population. So I don't see any political support for the government coming out and saying you're going back to a 1,500 square foot or to go back to the 1950s standard, which we see in Charlottesville. If you go up in the Locust Avenue area and go to the off streets like St. Clair and St. Charles, you'll see what the 1950s standard was, 1,200 square foot house, three bedrooms, one bathroom. I think it's pretty hard to put the genie back into that bottle. That said,
it's sort of like Carter saying, turn your thermostat down and put on a sweater.
It's not going to work.
Which, as much as my dad hated him, he took his advice.
Right. Well, it was good advice. That said, the government can influence people's consumption choices through the way it structures regulation. And in the old days, post-securitization, but before deregulation, if you think about what the Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac institutions were doing, they were basically saying to people, we'll give you a somewhat subsidized mortgage. We'll make it possible for you to get a mortgage at a lower rate than you would otherwise get, as long as you conform. That was the important word, right? That's how you know that there's some incentive or some coercion here. As long as you conform to the guidelines that we're setting out. And those guidelines did tend to steer people towards houses that were at the median price, right? It steered people towards more modest houses. Because in order to qualify for that mortgage, you had to put down between 10 and 20%.
Yeah, it's a lot.
And that's a lot to save that much money. So to find 10 or 20% of $600,000, that's a lot harder than finding 10 or 20% of $120,000, $150,000, $200,000.
Yeah, yeah.
And then the second thing that tended to keep people on best behavior in the conforming mortgage system was that your total housing payments, property taxes, insurance, principal, interest, could not exceed 28% of your gross income. So that put a limit on what you could borrow also. So government policy can influence what people do. And the track record on the Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac mortgages that were conforming up until last year was fantastic. And by fantastic, what I mean is only 0.5%, half a percent of those mortgages ever went into default.
Wow.
Right.
Gosh. So Sarah has a point. You can actually legislate sort of a framework that sort of keeps people modest and within their means.
You can give them incentives to behave that way.
Yeah.
And most people, given that most people, especially today, don't have the ability to save the kind of down payment that's required to buy a house. I use the $600,000 figure because that's kind of a median California figure. But most people don't have the capacity to save that much money. To save 10% of $600,000 means you've got to come up with $60,000.
Heck, who could save $10,000,
right,
you know?
And $60,000 is above the median household income in the U.S. for 1 year. So you basically have to save a year's worth of income to be able to qualify. So policy can push people into more modest dwellings.
Sarah, thank you for the call. It's a fantastic question. We're talking with Herman Schwartz of the University of Virginia. His new book is Subprime Nation. Herman, let me ask you this. When the crap hit the fan and everything started spiraling downward, politics-wise, we saw the sides very, very quickly find their devil. They very quickly placed blame. We saw conservatives blame, oh, it's all those people who were in homes that they couldn't afford. It's all those subprime people. And we saw the liberals very quickly say, it's Wall Street's fault, unscrupulous lenders, the deregulation run amok. What's the truth? Help us flesh that out.
Okay, let me start with put a number out first. And the number is, I'm going to put out two numbers. The first number is 30-70. So if I had to be backed into a corner and assess blame, Clinton administration versus Bush administration, I would say Clinton administration is about 30% responsible for this. Bush administration is about 70%. And the second number is $1.7 trillion, which is a lot of money. And what's that $1.7 trillion number? That's the total of subprime mortgages plus what are called Alt-A mortgages. And out of that $1.7 trillion, about $1.1 trillion is subprime, and $6 trillion is Alt-A. And Alt-A is people who have good credit, stable income, but are buying a house that's too big. They're the people that Sarah was looking askance at.
Yeah.
Okay. So a third of the mortgage debt that is in trouble is not subprime, first of all. Okay, now let's back up. And why do I say 30% Clinton, 70% Bush? First, let me say what doesn't matter, what never mattered in any serious way, is what's called mortgages given out under the Community Reinvestment Act, or CRA. There's been a lot of conservative noise about the CRA saying banks were forced to give mortgages to poor people who couldn't afford the mortgage.
Oh, yeah, we heard that all the time.
Yeah, we heard that all the time.
Talk radio, they're going nuts about these guys in Congress, these Democratic liberals who were forcing the banks to put people in homes they couldn't afford.
There's a list of words I can't say on the radio, but that argument falls somewhere in that list of words. You can find a lot of words in
that. So there wasn't
argument.
Much there.
There's not much there. And the reason that's not much there, if we just go through that quickly, is banks actually didn't have to give mortgages to people. And in the 90s, when the banks didn't have to give mortgages under the CRA, in the 90s, when banks wanted to merge, two things were true. One was that when they came to the regulators for permission to merge, they did have to have a good record under CRA. And the reason they had to have a good record under CRA was that what the CRA said was, if you take money from depositors in poor neighborhoods, and then you don't turn around and loan money back into those neighborhoods to people who have reasonably good credit or some kind of stable employment, then you're basically redlining. You're refusing to give mortgages to people on the basis of the neighborhood they live in.
You're just poaching that neighborhood.
You're poaching that neighborhood. And since those neighborhoods were predominantly black, there was a form of racial discrimination. So the CRA was a way to prevent racial discrimination and what you're calling poaching on neighborhoods.
From banks taking
the money
out of a neighborhood and putting it into another neighborhood.
Right, put it into a different neighborhood. Banks wanted to merge, and so they made mortgages under the CRA, and that was the original subprime mortgage. Those mortgages, very importantly, most of them were not securitized. And because banks knew that they were on the hook if those mortgages went bad, because the loans were on their books, they tended to scrutinize those borrowers very carefully. Most of those mortgages have not gone bad. So if you look at the subprime mortgages
really?
That have gone bad, yeah. If you look at the subprime mortgages that went bad, the vast majority of those mortgages were not made by banks. Now, bank is a technical term. A bank is a place that takes your money as a deposit, and that deposit is insured by the FDIC. The financial firms that were making the bulk of the subprime mortgages in the zeros were not banks. They were non-bank financial institutions. They were like Downey Financial. They were like
Washington
New Century.
Mutual.
No, WAMU actually is a real bank.
Oh, it is. Okay.
But yeah. And there's a what WAMU was doing and also what the other banks were doing, like the other local bank that starts with a W that doesn't exist anymore, was lending money to the non-bank financial institutions so they could then make the subprime mortgages. So most of the institutions making these subprime mortgages, the bulk of the $1.1 trillion of subprime is out of non-bank financial institutions. So here's why we say 30% Clinton, 70% Bush. The 30% Clinton is the end of the Glass-Steagall Act at the end of the 1990s, which said that commercial banks, banks that are in the business of taking short-term deposits and making short-term loans, can also do investment activities. And this allowed those banks, including the big ones like Citibank, et cetera, to take deposits and then invest those deposits in those securitized subprime mortgages that eventually went bad. So that's the 30% for Clinton. The 70% for Bush is precisely about those non-bank financial institutions. And in 2004, Ed Gramlich, who was on the Federal Reserve Bank board, went to the Treasury and went to the Fed and said, look, the non-bank financial institutions are making a lot of mortgages that are very dodgy. It's hard to see how these mortgages are going to get repaid. And we should do something about this. And as a consequence of that, a meeting was held with the Fed, the Treasury, and the other regulatory agencies like OCC, OTS. And at that meeting, the Bush administration made a decision not to regulate the non-bank financial institutions. So the issue here, the technical issue here, sorry to be too technical, but the technical issue here is that the Fed, the OTS, et cetera, don't really have authority to regulate non-bank financial institutions. But what they did have authority to do was to go to the WAMUs and the Wachovias of the world and say, don't give money to these non-bank financials. And if the supply of cash to the non-bank financials had dried up, they wouldn't have been able to make as many subprime mortgages as they made. So the Bush administration did have a tool to rein in the explosion of subprime lending.
And they didn't do it.
They chose not to do it. And they chose not to do it for political reasons. And the political reasons are the mirror image of the Clinton administration's reasons for pushing the CRA in the 1990s. And the reasons look something like this. Most in American politics, you win national elections for the most part by winning the votes of the one-third of white American families, that's people with children, who have incomes over $100,000. Nobody wants to talk about it quite in that way because it racializes it, it puts it into class terms.
But that's what's going on.
That's what's going on. When you hear people talk about soccer moms, security moms, that's who they're thinking about, those families. And coming out of the 90s and into the O's, the state of play was that the Republicans pretty consistently were getting a bit more than half of that voting bloc. And the only way the Democrats could win was to lock up or generate more votes from Latinos, blacks, and poor whites. And the strategy from the Clinton administration was move people, give people in the black community a stake, give them property, and if you do this through the CRA, they'll be politically loyal to the Democratic Party. The Bush administration's political strategy was somewhat the mirror image of that. They were basically saying, okay, we've got a bit more than half of this crucial white, rich voting bloc. If we go and we take away the Latino vote from the Democrats, and the Latino vote was very much in play, very volatile, if we go and we take that vote away, if we take away not the whole black vote, but if we just shave off 5-10% of the black vote from the Democrats, we'll get a lock on states that are now in play. We'll get Florida for sure. We'll get California maybe, or at least put it in play. We'll get New Mexico. We'll get Arizona. And the reason the Republicans thought this was possible was that they looked at these communities, Latinos and blacks, and said, look, they're culturally conservative. Latinos are Catholic. The black community is largely biddable on issues like gay marriage. They're culturally conservative, but economically, they're not conservative yet. So if we put these people into houses, they'll become both cultural conservatives and economic conservatives. And so the strategy was extend the mortgages, put people into houses, give them a stake, and then they'll start to vote Republican more reliably, or at least they'll be in play, and then we can win.
Which is why the regulators sat on their hands.
Which is why the regulators
when the banks were throwing
hands.
Money at the lending institutions.
Yes.
And they were going to subprime mortgages.
Yes, exactly.
We're talking with Herman Schwartz. The new book is Subprime Nation, American Power, Global Capital, and the Housing Bubble. We literally only have like a couple of minutes left, but I did want to ask you this one question. All that bailout money that we gave the banks, and the stimulus money we threw at the banks to save them, a lot of that money now is going to China. The banks aren't reinvesting it into America. They're sending it overseas.
Stimulus money didn't really go to the banks, but the other stuff, the TARP money, Troubled Asset Relief Program money, that went to the banks. And yes, what you say is not 100% true, but that's part of this guaranteed, we say carry trade, but this guaranteed profit-making scheme for the banks. If you give the banks a guarantee that they can borrow as much money as they want at extremely low interest rates from the government, and then don't tell them where they're going to put that money. They're, of course, going to take it where they can make the most money. And so,
China's what, 8% growth right now? So
China has 8% growth. Yeah. Stock market's booming. So, investment banks are borrowing at the Fed, borrowing from the Federal Reserve, and investing the money overseas to make those big profits in the short term that both fund the bonuses for the geniuses that are taking advantage of the one-way bet and also restore profitability for those firms, allow them to build up reserves to offset the losses.
Herman, we're going to have to get you back in here because I can talk for 2 more hours.
Well,
Herman,
you supply pizza, I'll come back.
Herman Schwartz, his new book is Subprime Nation, American Power, Global Capital, and the Housing Bubble. And we'll get him back on the program again really soon. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Charlottesville Right Now with Coy Barefoot. Charlottesville Right Now is broadcast live Monday through Friday on News Radio 1070 WINA from 4 to 6 p.m. Best-selling author and historian Coy Barefoot is the host and producer. To interact with Coy and his guests, you can call 434-977-1070. Coy can be reached at barefoot@wina.com. This audio download has been made possible by the Charlottesville Podcasting Network. Visit SevillePodcast.com for more.